Thank you, Your Honor, and Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Peter Hosharian, and I'll be presenting oral arguments on behalf of the petitioner, in this case, Zori Kashishian. The Board of Immigration Appeals found that there were four issues of credibility that were crucial to this case. If you'd recall, the only testimony that was provided was by the petitioner and by the petitioner's brother, Jirayer. And the court found, and the BIA also found, discrepant testimony in the employees in the room at the time of the incident where the petitioner's brother was hit by a wrench. The second area of discrepancy was the duties of an employee of the company, Yamudi. The third was whether or not his brother lost consciousness. And the fourth was the discrepancy in the hospital where his brother received medical care. Singh versus Ashcroft, this court clearly held that minor inconsistencies or factual omissions that do not go to the heart of the asylum claim are insufficient to support an adverse credibility finding.
But counsel, would you agree that we've also held that if the event concerns the central basis of the persecution, that the details of that central basis of persecution are important to be consistent?
I agree with that, Your Honor, and we don't believe that the discrepant testimony as far as the number of employees or who was present, the number of employees that were present at that time, rises to the level of being the heart of the asylum.
Okay, how about whether or not he lost consciousness?
Well, that was explained that we have to take into consideration that this was a 14-year-old who was helping his brother out during his summer break. That can be subjective, whether or not I've been knocked down before in a football game, but I never lost consciousness, and others thought I did lose consciousness.
But the IJ was not required to accept the explanation. The IJ received that explanation, but was the IJ required to accept that explanation as explaining the discrepant testimony?
No, but she was not required to accept that explanation, but she should have considered it as part of the reason why there would be discrepant testimony in that. Whether the brother says, I was not knocked out, I was not unconscious, and whether the petitioner thinks he was unconscious is a matter of subjective interpretation.
But why would you think that the IJ did not consider that explanation?
Well, I believe that IJ did not offer a cogent reason as to why she believed the discrepancy rose to the level of finding incredibility.
On the point of unconsciousness, and that seemed like a relatively traumatic issue, and doesn't the record establish that your client said that his brother was unconscious when he put him into the car? Wouldn't that be more than when maybe somebody with a football helmet on may or may not be seen to be unconscious, but this is a different factual scenario?
I understand, and it was the petitioner that said he believed his brother was unconscious, but whether or not his brother believed he was out or out cold, or whether his brother may have been unconscious, but when he came to, never really realized that he was unconscious. There's times when people black out and never know that they have blacked out.
Okay.
But we're looking at this as whether or not substantial evidence supports the IJ decision. So we have to be compelled to come to the opposite conclusion. And perhaps the IJ could have gone the other way on this issue, and we would still probably say that the IJ's determination was supported by substantial evidence. If the evidence can go either way, and the IJ selects one outcome as opposed to the other, how can we say that there is no substantial evidence in the record to support that determination?
Well, I believe we have to go back to whether or not that was the heart of the petitioner's claim. Again, going back to the wrench incident, if I was somebody came and hit me with a wrench right now, and you polled this audience at a later time, several years later, and asked them who was in the room at the time, I think you'd have discrepant testimony going all over
the
place.
But in this case, the brothers, this was the event that supports the persecution claim. So it's a very important event in their lives. And if we are to believe that this rose to the level of persecution, then the details, the devil is in the details regarding how consistent the details are.
Right, and there were many, many consistencies in the testimony between both brothers, and I believe those consistencies outweigh the inconsistencies that are listed here by the BIA and the IJ.
The problem I'm having with your argument is that we don't sit here as the initial determiner of the facts. We don't get to weigh the facts. We only get to determine whether or not there is substantial evidence in the record to support the determination that was made by the fact finder. So what does that do to your argument?
Well, Your Honor, my argument goes these discrepancies were listed in detail by both the immigration judge and the Board of Immigration Appeals. And taking them in and of themselves, they don't go to the heart of the asylum claim. The fact of the matter remains that the brother was hit by a wrench, and the brother suffered injuries. The brother was taken to the hospital, and
which hospital?
Well, that was a discrepant fact, but the petitioner was not a percipient witness as to what hospital the brother went to. He did not go to the hospital. The petitioner's father took the brother to the hospital, and petitioner.
But he testified specifically about a hospital. Which hospital? Both of them testified he was taken to a hospital. They just said different hospitals.
Right.
So now that, unlike the unconsciousness, which if we accepted your suggestion that sometimes someone may be unconscious or appear and not be, this is pretty much an objective fact, the name of a hospital. If it's Hospital A versus Hospital B, there's no question they're two separate hospitals. And this is just one more item that was inconsistent. And how about the job description of the one witness that both parties acknowledged was there? I'm sure I can pronounce it. Yumadi?
Yumadi.
They're completely different versions of what his duties were.
Well, again, the petitioner, 14-year-old, he's there on summer break. He's not engaged in this work as his brother is. And for him to know the job duties of every single employee there, in comparison with his brother, I don't think the court could expect someone of that age the nature of why he was there helping his brother out to know the ins and outs of that particular business.
Or he could have just said, I'm not sure.
I was wondering if you might want to save, a minute and a half or so for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Perspective on what the government argues.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'd also like to bring up the petitioner is a candidate for prosecutorial discretion, and we've made a motion to mediate on that behalf, and we've...
All right. We'll probe the government on how amenable the government is to that idea.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning again, Your Honors.
Good morning. So is the government amenable to sending this case to mediation to explore the exercise of prosecutorial discretion?
The preliminary indication is that DHS would not positively exercise its discretion in this case, but should petitioner seek to pursue the request, then respondent is not opposed to placing the case in mediation.
All right, so in practical terms, there's a motion pending for the case to go to mediation. So can I take your representation to mean there is no opposition to the motion?
That's correct.
All right, thank you.
Would you like me to proceed on the merits?
Please.
Sure. This court should dismiss the petition for review to the extent that it challenges the agency's denial of asylum, and deny the petition for review to the extent that it challenges the agency's denial of withholding of removal and protection under the Convention Against Torture. As a threshold matter, this court lacks jurisdiction over the agency's determination that petitioner failed to file his asylum application in a timely manner. Although this court has determined that it retains jurisdiction over mixed questions of law and fact in the case of Ramadan, and that a timeliness determination may sometimes be a mixed question of law and fact, the court has also held that it lacks jurisdiction to review the immigration judge's timeliness determination where the applicant's date of arrival is not an undisputed fact.
Well, counsel, in this case, where was the dispute in the record regarding the date of entry into the United States?
The immigration judge wasn't certain that the individual who petitioner presented as his brother was in fact his brother, and although there were other affidavits in the record, the conclusion was that the evidence simply wasn't sufficient to demonstrate the date of entry.
But there was no adverse credibility determination regarding the testimony of the petitioner on the date of entry.
All of petitioner's testimony was found not to be credible by the immigration judge. She found that he simply wasn't a credible witness. And in that case, the date of entry is part of that finding. And therefore, the agency determined the application was untimely, and it's not within this court's jurisdiction to address it because it's not an undisputed fact as to when he entered the United States. The court does, however, have jurisdiction to review the agency's adverse credibility determination. And as Your Honor recognized, the credibility determination is reviewed under the substantial evidence standard, which is a deferential standard under which the determination will be upheld so long as it's supported by specific cogent reasons that go to the heart of the applicant's claim for asylum. As explained by this court, even if some of the grounds relied upon by the immigration judge are unsupported or irrelevant, so long as one of the identified grounds goes to the heart of the claim, and the court is bound to accept the immigration judge's adverse credibility determination. Now, here the agency's credibility determination is supported by several inconsistencies between the testimony provided by Mr. Kishishian and the testimony provided by his sole witness regarding the central incident underpinning his asylum claim, an alleged attack which occurred at his brother's workplace on July 13, 1999. As noted by the immigration judge and the board, there were several inconsistencies. The board pointed to four in particular, which and how many colleagues were present, the occupation of Mr. Yamudi and what he was doing on the day of the attack, whether Armin, the brother, had lost consciousness, and which hospital he was taken to. Now, the board noted that the age of Mr. Kishishian might have been a relevant factor if Mr. Kishishian had said, "I cannot recall." But in this case, he actively indicated that he could recall, and he did recall. And then he provided testimony which was inconsistent with the testimony of the individual who was alleged to be his brother.
Counsel, Judge Gould, if I could interject a question.
Certainly.
What the government certainly has going for it the standard of review in this case, so that even if one of the grounds for adverse credibility that went to the heart of the matter is okay, I think the government wins. But going against the government's position is, in my mind at least, is a practical problem. It's this. It's been a lot of years, well, it's more than I can remember, since I was in a fight. But I probably was in high school at least once. And, you know, when people are in a fight, they often can't remember details of what's around, like how many people are standing around, and even some post-fight details. So it makes me a little uneasy about the government's reliance or the IJ's reliance on things like, were there five people standing around or 10 people? You know, because I'm not sure that the average person, if in a fight, or if witnessing a fight where their brother was attacked with a wrench, would necessarily notice if there are, you know, five people there or 10 people. So, I mean, how do you respond to that, that the intense emotional atmosphere of an attack on the brother with a wrench you know, might cloud some of the details.
Allow me to just make 2 points in response to that question. The first is, as noted by the board, it would have been one thing if Mr. Kashishian had said, I can't recall. If he had said, I can't recall, perhaps the analysis might have been a little different. But he did recall, and there were inconsistencies. And the second response is that there were several inconsistencies, in fact, more cited by the immigration judge than ultimately cited by the board in its 2009 decision. And these inconsistencies, one after the other, had deprived the claim of the requisite ring of truth. The immigration judge heard 2 stories which were different on several different points and ultimately was left scratching their head saying, you know, I'm not sure what to believe because there are so many inconsistencies here. And so when there are so many inconsistencies, even if each one of them is minor, added up together, they leave the immigration judge uncertain that the applicant is, in fact, testifying credibly.
And certainly be correct, I think, in a post-Real ID Act case, because you can look at a whole bunch of small inconsistencies. But here we can only look at them if they go to the heart of the matter, right?
That's correct. And if the inconsistencies did not relate to one of the central elements of petitioner's claim, then the Real ID Act issue would be, in fact, quite relevant. But because this was the central incident which underpins his asylum claim, this incident which occurred to his brother at work, it does go to the heart of the claim because all of these little facts surrounding that incident relate to his request for asylum, the main basis for his request. And therefore,
okay,
his...
Thank you.
Sure.
So, counsel, going back to the timeliness of the asylum application, it appears that the IJ analyzed that issue separately and did not make an explicit adverse credibility determination in that portion of the decision. Do you have a case that says the adverse credibility determination that's made in conjunction with determining the merits of the asylum carries over to the untimeliness of the asylum application? I'm just curious as to whether or not there's a case. You made that representation, and I was just curious if there's a case that says that finitely.
I'm not familiar with the case which says exactly that point, but the credibility determination, it could be credibility with respect to a particular portion of a claim, but generally speaking, when an immigration judge makes a credibility determination, they're determining the credibility of the witness. And if the immigration judge determines that the witness is not providing credible testimony, unless the immigration judge states that the credibility determinations with respect to one portion or the other of the testimony, and the credibility determination is with respect to all of the testimony of the applicant.
Well, that's not necessarily true because a CAT claim is considered separate and apart. The adverse credibility determination is not determinative of the CAT claim.
That's correct.
So that's why I'm asking you, does the adverse credibility determination carry over to the untimeliness because the CAT claim is analyzed separately and apart from the adverse credibility determination? I'm asking you, does a similar analysis apply when we're looking at the untimeliness application?
With respect to the Convention Against Torture, the immigration judge has to look at things like country conditions evidence to determine whether there is a probability of torture in the country. And so there may be objective evidence in the record unrelated to testimony, credible or incredible, by the applicant, which could render him or her eligible for protection under the Convention Against Torture. And that's what this Court said in Camalthus, that the IJ has to engage in a separate determination under the Convention Against Torture.
Well, there's a separate analysis, too, for the untimeliness of the application, and we make a determination whether or not the facts are disputed or undisputed. So it's a little bit different, and the IJ treated it a little bit differently and analyzed it separately. So that's why there is a little uncertainty in my mind regarding whether or not the adverse credibility determination that was made in the merits of the asylum application carries over. And I was just curious if you knew of a case that resolved that particular point.
Sure. Well, Your Honor, there was an alternative argument made in Respondent's brief that even if this Court does have jurisdiction to determine the issue, that the timeliness determination is supported by the record, where there were affidavits and the testimony of petitioner and an individual who claimed to be his brother, but that the adverse credibility was not overcome by such evidence. And that's the alternative argument presented in Respondent's brief.
So. All right. Thank you, counsel. Any other questions from the panel?
None here, thank you.
All right, thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
We'll hear a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd just like to use my time to address the one-year issue as well. Like Your Honor said, there is no case law that I'm aware of that says that adverse credibility finding carries over to the one-year issue.
What did the judge say about that when he decided that it was not shown by clear and convincing evidence that it was brought within a year? What did he say on the record?
I believe the judge found that there was no documentary evidence that was supporting the petitioner's. But
what did he say about the credibility of the witness?
She made any determination about the credibility.
She certainly did make an explicit adverse credibility determination in that.
She did, but she.
She did not in the timeliness when she was talking about the timeliness issue. She did not make an explicit adverse credibility determination, which raised the question in my mind as to whether or not the subsequent explicit adverse credibility determination related back to this part. Because she said there's some skepticism about the testimony, but under our case authority, that's not enough.
Right. And in going further, she did not offer any articulable basis to question the petitioner's credibility or offer any specific or cogent reasons for her stated disbelief.
Well, she said she would discuss it later, in her opinion. I was wondering if that was enough to tie them in together, but that's neither here nor there. So did you want to make any other statements about the merits of the asylum claim?
Your Honor, basically, it again goes back to the point both the differences between the brother and both brothers' testimony can be very subjective. Like Judge Gould brought up, that kind of traumatic experience can alter somebody's memory, especially getting hit by a wrench in your head, basically getting taken to a hospital, and you might remember some facts, you might not remember others. So we can't hold those discrepancies, do not go to the heart of the matter, which was he was struck by the wrench, and he did receive medical treatment for that.
All right, thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to both counsel. The case just argued is submitted for decision by the court. The last three cases on calendar, BGI Life versus American General, the last two cases, and Reeves versus Colvin have been submitted on the briefs. The final case for calendar on